Hey, Bankless listeners. This is Ryan here. You guys are in for a treat today. So the episode you're about to hear was pulled from our new Limitless podcast feed. That's a podcast feed that I occasionally host. I'm a guest host on that, along with David and also our new Limitless co-host, Josh. So as you're about to hear in this episode, the intelligence curse is not just an AI topic, it's a crypto topic. This is about AI people discovering that without decentralization, the future of AI is kind of bleak. These aren't just technologies, these are political systems. Now moving forward, episodes like this will be on the Limitless feed, so you won't see them here anymore. See, what you need to do is stop what you're doing and go subscribe to Limitless. Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get podcasts, there's a link in the show notes for all of these. Limitless explores the frontier of AI the same way Bankless explores the frontier of crypto. We believe these are the two frontiers for wealth generation and freedom this decade. Bankless and Limitless, AI and crypto, this is how you level up on both. Enjoy the episode.
In the wild west of DeFi, stability and innovation are everything, which is why you should check out Frax Finance, the protocol revolutionizing stablecoins, DeFi, and Rolex. The core of Frax Finance is Frax USD, which is backed by BlackRock's institutional Biddle Fund. Frax designed Frax USD for best-in-class yields across DeFi, T-bills, and carry trade returns all in one. Just head to Frax.com, then stake it to earn some of the best yields in DeFi. Want even more? Bridge your Frax USD over to the Fraxtl Layer 2 for the same yield plus Fraxtl points, and explore Fractal's diverse Layer 2 ecosystem with protocols like Curve, Convex, and more, all rewarding early adopters. Frax isn't just a protocol. It's a digital nation powered by the FXS token and governed by its global community. Acquire FXS through Frax.com or your go-to DEX, stake it, and help shape Frax Nation's future. Ready to join the forefront of DeFi? Visit Frax.com now to start earning with Frax USD and staked Frax USD. And for Bankless listeners, you can use Frax.com/r/Bankless when bridging to Frax for exclusive Fraxtl perks and boosted rewards. Uniswap is your gateway to a more efficient DeFi experience. With Uniswap, swapping and bridging across 13 chains is simple, fast, and cost-effective, helping you move value wherever, whenever. Thanks to deep liquidity on the Uniswap protocol, you'll enjoy minimal price impact on every trade. And now Uniswap V4 takes it even further. Swappers benefit from gas savings on multi-hop swaps and ETH trading pairs, while liquidity providers can create new pools at 99% lower costs. The best part, you don't have to do anything extra. Each trade is automatically routed through Uniswap X, V2, V3, and V4, so you get the most efficient swap without even thinking about it. Whether you're swapping, sending, on-ramping, off-ramping, or bridging, Uniswap's web app and wallet gives you the tools to unlock DeFi's full potential on Ethereum, Base, Arbitrum, Unichain, and more. Use Uniswap's web app and wallet for a more efficient way to use DeFi. Imagine verifying yourself without handing over personal data. No hacked databases, no unnecessary personal exposure for airdrops, and no AI bots ruining community governance. Meet Self, the on-chain identity verification protocol built for privacy and control. Self protocol uses zero-knowledge proofs to confirm your identity safely. Users prove key details like age or citizenship without revealing sensitive personal information. Self never stores your data. It only generates cryptographic proofs. Here's how it works in three steps. First, register and verify. Use the Self app to scan your biometric passport's RFID chip. Self verifies authenticity with zero-knowledge proofs. Each passport creates one unique identity. Second, you can share proofs privately. Third-party apps request identity proofs, like confirming you're over 18. You can also link proofs securely to public wallets for airdrops or governance participation. And then last, secure verification. Apps validate your proofs instantly on-chain, like on Celo, or off-chain. Audited by ZK Security, the Self app is live on iOS and Play Store. Visit self.xyz and follow Self Protocol on X.
So the intelligence curse, pretty briefly defined, is the set of incentives that we might get when we unlock artificial general intelligence. And we're using the OpenAI definition here, which is the ability to automate most or all human labor. And in that world, we're really concerned that governments, powerful actors, corporations won't have that incentive to care about regular people. That doesn't mean they guarantee won't, but it means that strong economic incentive that we've had for basically all of human history, where powerful actors have needed regular people, and so there's an exchange of goods and benefits. If you sever that, you're relying a whole lot on goodwill. And we think that's not nearly as stable or strong of an arrangement, and it mirrors the kind of patterns you see in economies like those that are afflicted with the resource curse.
Are regular people just everybody? Just like, you know, you, me, white-collar workers, you know, people in developing countries, people in very developed countries? Like, who are the regular people to which you speak of?
Yeah, so I think we really do mean here everyone, in particular maybe like everyone who does not have capital that is then like very dependent on AI, that it can be physical capital or financial capital. And I think there's people often talk about white collar workers. There's also people in developing countries, of course, who we shouldn't ignore their existence. So it really does mean everyone. Where like right now the state is that everyone can contribute economically. States and companies have an incentive to care about everyone. But then if all of everyone's labor is replaced, then this is less true.
So I'm really curious to ask you guys, why now? What did you see that sparked the interest to actually make this post? Because you read through it and it was very, very thoughtful, very pragmatic. But what was it that sparked this now versus a year ago or a year in the future? Was this the exact right time, or do you think this thesis kind of changes as we progress over the next few years?
So I think for us, just for some history of how we got here, I think shortly after O3 was announced and it looked like, oh, timelines are getting pretty short. AGI doesn't look 20 years away or 50 years away. It might look 5 years away or even sooner than that. I think we were having a series of conversations. We worked at the same building at the time, or the same office building. And I'd had this observation about the resource curse, and how this looks somewhat similar to those patterns. And Rudolph had separately been working on this draft of an essay, which is now in the full series called Capital, AGI, and Human Ambition. Mm. We published earlier versions of those essays back in January that were didn't propose any sort of like solution or way to try to stop this problem. And we spent the next 3 or 4 months of banging our head against the wall, trying to figure out, well, what can we do about this? What does it look like to actually solve this problem? A whole lot of the related essays in the piece that aren't squarely focused on the solution were essays that we were kind of writing and taking notes on as we got what we thought was closer and closer. And in the last couple of weeks, I think we just thought we had enough. And so we went ahead and hit the publish button. We are big fans of shipping in public.
Yeah, I think also to mention on the timelines, I think there's also something about like when AGI is far away, it feels very much like a technical problem. And I think for a long time, a lot of the people who take AGI seriously have been thinking about it purely for the technical lens, thinking about the systems. And I think just as it draws nearer, you start realizing that, okay, it's not just going to be a technical thing. This is actually going to interact with the rest of society, with the real world. It's going to have like very concrete effects. And that says maybe we should actually think about those.
It seems important. And it's funny because at Limitless, we're very optimistic about the future. We're very excited about the pro tech, pro AI future. Yeah. And then Ryan surfaced this document with me, your post. And I was like, I was reading through it and I was, it kind of hurt a little bit. I was like, this isn't the future that I'm super excited about, but it was very thoughtful and very pragmatic. And I wanted to ask you guys, why did you define this as the intelligent curse? Why is intelligence not a blessing?
So I think the name just strictly comes from the comparison to the resource curse. And while I don't think we don't root the entire analysis in the resource curse, it's a very helpful example to really conceptualize what is a similar environment that has similar incentives, what are the outcomes there. But the initial observation was this looks a whole lot like the resource curse in development economics. And so that's kind of where the name came from. There's this huge wealth of existing literature and debates. We didn't want to center the entire argument on that, but we did think that name seemed quite relevant here. And I think in particular, why it might be a curse as opposed to a blessing, it really depends on how it gets deployed. If it's a centralizing or decentralizing technology, if it accumulates power in the hands of the few or distributes power out to many, many people. And so I think it can be a curse. And we set out the scenario for which it could be a curse, but we also offer the world in which it could be a blessing.
There's so much really to unpack here. And like some of our history at Limitless comes from also crypto, right? And I know the series of essays, you referenced Vitalik Buterin's work on decentralized or defensive accelerationism. And we've had him on the podcast actually talk about that. And that might be indeed one of the ways out. But when you start to talk about decentralization, that very much does seem like maybe our main defense against the centralizing effect of this. But I don't want to project us too far forward in the solution. And there's so much to unpack here, so much to go through. We'll do it kind of sequentially by route of essay. But one thing I do want to get, since we've defined it, we haven't defined it yet, but we've dropped this phrase, the resource curse, several times so far. Luke, could you just define what the resource curse actually is? I believe this pertains to countries and how endowed they are with maybe natural resources. Tell us about the resource curse and why it's basically a meme for the name of this essay.
Yeah, so I'll stress first that it's not the sole piece of evidence we rest on. It's very much so an example or an analogy that we want to build around. But the resource curse, succinctly put, is the tendency for countries that have lots of natural resources to oftentimes, instead of having very rich or wealthy citizens, to have actually worse conditions. And there are a lot of different explanatory mechanisms for why that can happen. But one of them that I think is pretty prominent in the literature is that if you have oil in the ground and all it takes for your state to get really wealthy is to get oil out of the ground, onto the roads, and onto the ports. Well, your incentives are not to build this really complex economy. Your incentives are to make as much money out of oil as you can. And it doesn't require a whole lot of people to make money off of oil. It might require workers to actually extract the resource and to get it out to the ports and to sell it. But that's a whole lot less people involved in an economy than, let's say, a more developed, advanced economy like the United States, where there's lots of moving parts here. Now, there's a lot of different ways the resource curse ends up, but for a whole lot of countries, particularly those that don't have really strong institutions, the resource curse ends up in pretty terrible poverty. There are ways out that we think, we kind of talk later through the piece as to, you know, what ways are out, what ways are potential like analogies here that we could be looking to for solutions. But the core thing here is that you either want a diversified economy or you want institutions that can withstand the curse.
Okay, and the examples of that are just, you know, countries in the Middle East maybe that are oil rich and they really haven't developed their, I guess, civil liberties or kind of the labor economies of their citizens, right? Or maybe a country like Russia, which is kind of in the grip of authoritarian, totalitarian, you know, powers, and it's, you know, they kind of devolved into a plutocracy. I suppose that's what you mean by the resource curse. Now, we also have a counterexamples, maybe like Norway mm-hmm. is very well endowed. There's a lot of energy there. Canada might be another example. I mean, they seem to be doing fairly well with a liberal democracy. But the counterintuitive thing here, and why you're labeling this the intelligence crisis, you would think that more resources equals like better. More resources equals better for everybody. And it turns out that's actually not the case for resources, for nation states when it comes to natural resources. Sometimes more resources actually lead to an incentive structure that makes things worse for the population. And that could be the same with the intelligence curse.
Yeah, that's what we're saying. And we also think that there's a lot of signs of hope there. We talk a lot about Norway and we talk a bit about Oman as well as two examples of states that broke them and broke the curse, what we can learn from those. But yeah, I mean, states like the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example, or Nigeria that are just like really, they have tons of resources and yet their people are very poor. And the question is, well, what are the incentives that are creating this outcome?
Okay, so let's now that we've got kind of the gist of it, let's flesh out this argument in a lot more detail. And you have basically a series of essays with different sections on this. But when I was kind of looking at the high level thesis, it feels like you're playing with a few, you know, premises, like so maybe three in my mind. Like one is that AGI is the only game worth playing. There's a famous essay titled this as well. But basically, AGI accrues incredible capability and power. And he's just, as you said, this could be like on the near-term horizon. We're talking about years, maybe 5 years, for instance. Mm-hmm. So that's like the first premise you sort of have to believe. The second is that AI will replace humans for valuable economic labor. And we're going to flesh that out in a second. And as a result of that second premise, the third kind of, I guess, idea here is that powerful actors, these would be like nation states and companies, they no longer have an incentive to care about the regular people, as you said. Why? Because the regular people used to be their economic engine and their labor. But now with AGI, the regular people aren't providing utility. So do we need these welfare states? Do we need these social structures? Do we need civil liberties? Okay, so that's the base idea we're going to flesh out. And it begins here, which is this concept of pyramid replacement. I want you to sharpen this mental model. So AIs, this idea that AIs will replace humans for all valuable labor. And I'm showing on the screen a picture of a corporation, I think. This is a typical company. You know, companies are arranged in hierarchies. At the base of the pyramid, you have your entry-level employees. In the very top, you have the executives. You have the C-suite. So can you describe what this pyramid actually is in the typical corporation and what you see AIs doing to this pyramid?
Yeah, so basically, so there is currently this hierarchical structure in companies, and then it's actually not from first principles obvious which end of the pyramid AI will start automating first, but like empirically, it seems like AIs are getting good at tasks that have short time horizons where the task is completed quickly and then you move on to the next thing pretty quickly and getting better at longer time horizon tasks slower. And there's also the social fact that the C-suite is less likely to unemploy themselves than to unemploy other people. And the easiest people to also unemploy are the entry-level employees because you don't need to fire anyone. You just stop hiring. Yes. And that's why we think the like first step in automation, something that might already be happening in software companies, is that the entry-level employees, instead of hiring more and more of them in the company, you just, instead of giving the senior developers at a software company an entry-level intern or something, you just give that senior developer Cursor. And they code with Cursor or with some other AI coding tool, and they don't need the entry-level employees anymore.
So, Ryan, if you don't mind scrolling down just a little bit, what I loved about this section was kind of the visual that you guys created, which showed this pyramid, and the pyramid is blue, and that means it's all humans. And then as AI starts to roll out, it starts to absorb the entry-level employees. And then as it goes to junior and as it goes to middle management, it slowly absorbs the bottom layers until eventually we're just left with the C-suite on top and then nothing. And then everything gets absorbed to AI. So
it's,
I guess,
just literally like one big AI, like red block, right? The pyramid becomes just like this AI Borg machine something.
It's no longer a pyramid, it's a square.
Yeah, it's a square.
This is one of the... I like that. I might steal that. But this is one of the things we changed from the original essay. I think I still have like the rough draft published on my blog. But originally, it was just the pyramid kept getting smaller and nothing was replacing it. And you get to this last slide and it's just blank. And we had like an outline of a square for like that looked like it was just part of the picture the whole time. And then at this point, just like there's nothing. I think I wrote the org chart goes blank. And Rudolph had the idea of maybe we should just like show people an entire automated company, actually show it's not just that the people are going away, but that AI is rapidly filling those functions. So now you've got the visual in front of you.
And there's also something here where, like, we don't want to imply that when the AI takes over, you know, in the future company, for every human employee, there will now be one AI agent that does, you know, like mashes one-to-one with each original human employee. I think the optimal way to structure AIs in companies will probably look a bit different from the like current thing where you stack humans into a pyramid, and therefore the AI, you know, we represent with this like the square thing that sort of like is like blob of AI computes around your sort of like shrinking amount of humans that are like providing a direction.
And this was what I was curious to ask now, is because currently in the world of AI, I feel like I am a leveraged human when I use it, where I'm capable of X, and then because of AI, I'm capable of Y. And I guess the question to you is will humans not just get better jobs? I guess if you could imagine stacking the pyramid on top of the AI, where now we have this foundation that provides a lot of leverage for entry-level employees all the way up to CEOs, but the productive output that's unlocked as a result of that leverage creates new and interesting problems for them to tackle. So would that not be the case where we become hyper-leveraged humans while removing some of the workforce, but not all of it?
Yeah, why can't this be a box with like a pointy hat, you know, pointy pyramid hat on top?
Well, for what it's worth, if you go one up, you'll actually find that box with a nice pointy hat on top. I guess the real question is the way that we currently structure our like major white collar companies, these like big mega conglomerates, is it's a company of like a couple hundred thousand people, like 10,000 people. And if you look at one, the success stories, and two, the existing statement CEOs are making, on the success story side, like Cursor has demonstrated that you can be a multi-billion dollar company getting tons of money with only a couple of people there. And if the general advice is you should only hire as many people as you need to run the organization, I'm not sure why Cursor would then hire 50,000 additional people. I'm not sure if that would actually buy them additional runway right now. But I think maybe what's more important anecdotally, and then Rudolph, I head off to the more systematic argument, but I think Duolingo's CEO has now said they're an AI-first company, and this means they're going to ask in every role they hire, every contract position that they have, whether or not they can automate this first. I think we have at the bottom some links to other companies who've also made similar statements here. I can't recall off the top of my head all of them, but I mean, the general ethos that we're hearing right now, as this is kicking off, is well, what we really want to be doing here is being more efficient, being leaner. And Rudolph, I hand it off to you for the more systematic argument.
Yeah, and I guess I think there is some hope that humans currently have this advantage in long horizon tasks. I think basically we know how to train AIs to do tasks for which there's a large data set, or where we can build a digital environment, reinforcement learning environment, where the correct behavior is rewarded. And this works for things like writing, where there's a lot of data on it, and you just train to write like the average intern person pretty well. And it works for things like math or code, where it's easy to verify whether something is correct. But then it's harder to train AIs to like be the CEO, because the CEO interacts with the real world. They take a lot of actions. This is just like we're currently less good at getting AIs to be good at this stuff. So I think the stage where like the AI uplifts the humans, this will continue for a while and probably longer than some of the most aggressive AI projections estimate. And I think there is hope that we can extend this period during which humans are mostly just uplifted by the AI. And this will be like a very good for just human agency and like ability of humans to affect change in the world. I think right now we are definitely in this regime. But then in the limit, there's no theoretical reason why the AI can't just also get good at the long-term planning. That's what the AGL labs are trying to crack right now. And at some point, the like board will come in, and the board will be like, look, you're the CEO, you have a nice job, but like, I'm sorry, but it looks like a GPT-9 is, you know, starting to get better at making decisions than you are. And we're responsible to shareholders, and I'm very sorry, you've done a good job, but now
can
we're
we
going to have to lay you
off. Can we start at the top? That would be kind of nice for a change.
You know, I've gotten a couple of those reactions. And I think the way that we're most likely to be wrong wrong on this model, and I want to be, you know, as like epistemically rigorous as I can be, is that the middle gets cut first. It could be the case that there are entry-level roles that we just really need a whole lot of people to be doing the like the basic work, and management becomes dramatically easier. I think the evidence really points towards the former, that we're getting this bottom-up pattern of automation as opposed to this middle out right now. And I think the reason for that is it's just quite simple. If it cost you $50,000 to hire a person to do something every year, but it would cost you $10,000 in compute to do the exact same task, it's really hard to justify the additional $40,000. And sure, like Mike's a great analyst and you go golfing with him on the weekend, but that's $40,000. And you can go golfing with Mike whether or not you work with him. And so I think a lot of companies, when you know, whether it's a downturn or whether they just want to save some money, they're faced with that question.
Luke, that was a spoken like a member of the C-suite. Let me tell you, that is...
you know. I actually can't play golf.
Sorry, Mike.
I really can't play golf.
We can golf, but you can no longer work here. So you guys are kind of, I guess you see it maybe emerging right now as sort of bottom up, where, you know, entry level programmers kind of are the first to go, or like support teams, customer support, something like that, kind of the first to go, and works its way upward. But you're also agnostic in this model as to whether it's kind of middle out or even top down, or whether it's bottom up. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is particular to white collar jobs. Yes. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
Is that part of the thesis, that you kind of the information, like knowledge worker class, is kind of going to be the first to go because our robotics technology hasn't quite caught up to our software LLMs?
Yeah, I think that's the default. I think right now, at least, LLMs are advancing faster than robotics. And this creates the interesting possibility. I think Carl Shulman talks about this idea that we might have a period where humans are valuable not for their brains, but for their hands. And maybe we get this if we have like a robotics.
That sounds worse.
when I made this concrete, imagine your job is just, you're like assembling widgets in a factory, but you have an earpiece where the AI is giving you instructions, and it gives you like motivational posts from time to time to keep you on task or something. And then, but you don't actually have to do any thinking because the AIs are better at all thinking. Like, maybe this is the future. However, don't worry. Maybe we also fix the robotics and we get robotics quickly, and then you can't do the widgets either. You're just like fully unemployed. So there are many possibilities here.
Okay, so that's the concept of pyramid replacement. Mm-hmm. And let's do some pushback though. Some objections to this. One is kind of the, I guess this is maybe the, at least I'm familiar with the Tyler Cowen kind of pushback argument, where he's basically like, you know, there's diffusion barriers. And we've certainly seen this, like, you know, kind of coming from crypto. So like, you know, crypto could replace the entire world's money system. But guess what? There's actually regulators who kind of don't want that to happen, right? There's institutions, there's structures, there's all sorts of breaks in society, meat space, government, that just slow things down. It's kind of the human piece of it. And so you might have this technology in a box, in a geniuses in a data center, whatever, but they might not diffuse through society because society has all of these breaks, and, you know, like big breaks in meat space. And so will that kind of slow this down? I mean, it feels like we can adapt better. I mean, just the general idea is we can adapt better if this happens very slowly versus if this happens like in a period of like months to years. And what do you think about that diffusion argument?
So one, I think a lot of our like solutions focus on in the breaking the intelligence curse section is really at its core an argument to try to extend the augmentation window so that we get more time to adapt. And I think if you look at the way the pyramid replacement flows right now, we argue it happens pretty slowly. It's a bottom-up approach. I don't think we give an exact time horizon because it's really hard to predict. But I mean, I think if AGI hits in 2027, I think most people are still employed in 2028. The question really for you is how fast after that moment. And there are a couple of reasons why you should expect companies would want to speed up pretty quickly. Maybe, for example, they don't do the automation, but a competitor does and they start moving faster. So now there's a competitive pressure to automate. In the same way that maybe a state doesn't want to acquire certain weapons capability, but of course the other state has also acquired that capability and now you're in a race to kind of get to the top here. Maybe it's the case there's an economic downturn and this forces like cost cutting everywhere, and you do the layoffs and discover that you actually are like at equal productivity or maybe even faster when you try to automate that away. So there are a lot of diffusion barriers. We do not think that this 6 months after AGI, everyone's unemployed. But it's also important to note that diffusion barriers also have acceleratory pressures that are pushing against them. If you have this kind of technology and there's strong reasons to adopt, if investors are hyping it up, if people are seeing it work in the real world, it really is only a matter of time before critical mass starts to emerge and the way that we work has fundamentally changed.
Okay. And there's been other points that talk about, you know, sort of AI being very jagged now, right? Where, you know, like some things you look at its output and you're like, oh my God, you are so dumb. Like, I could do this. And other things you're like, wow, this is incredible. And so this could happen in a jagged way, I guess. I feel like we've established then that there is the possibility, if we get this kind of like acceleration towards some sort of an AGI, that AIs have the capability to replace the corporate human pyramid. And I guess this is the capability to, I mean, corporations, companies are the economic engine of like basically all societies, right? So that's effectively what we're doing, is we're replacing the economic engine of these societies. Let's move to kind of the second essay and the second piece of this intelligence curse, where we start to talk about capital. All right, so now we've got a world where AIs have maybe started to erode, replace the human labor pyramids, our corporations, they're doing the work. And so I think you're making an argument here that the power, which was in the hands of labor, of course, capital always has power, but we have a large portion of labor in society because humans are valuable that has power, that would begin to shift. And this is almost like a startling revelation that the AIs might make non-human factors in production more important than the human ones, and particularly capital. Can you develop some intuition for that for us?
Yeah. So first, I think it's worth clarifying that capital, when economists talk about it, often means, you know, like it means money, it means, but it also means stuff like physical factories. And therefore, like economists talk about factors of production, like land, labor, capital management. And like capital here is a bucket that includes things like factories, GPUs, and also just like cash on hand. And I think—
Does it include energy too, Rudolf?
Yeah, I think economists would call energy a type of capital, because okay, it's a like non-human factor of production. It's not land, which works a bit differently, and it's not management, which is, for our purposes, kind of a bit like labor, because both involve humans currently. So yeah, and then it's basically, the quantification here is just the point about like, right now the economy needs a huge amount of human input, and you add more human input on the margin and the economy goes, you know, up, and therefore the marginal unit of human labor is like compensated pretty highly, and like at least compared to the historical like precedent here. And I think you can see this like historically, so like before the Industrial Revolution, where the human factor is like human capital and sort of like education skills, stuff like this was less important because there was less like real thinking technology, less like complicated processes, then also the like amount of power that human labor had was lower. And then, yeah, so this is sort of like general argument. And then in this essay in particular, we talk a lot about just this like point that you can just start substituting capital for labor more effectively than you can right now. And it's actually like, I think right now, for instance, if you're trying to hire talented people, that's actually like a big bottleneck on your ability to like convert money into results in the real world. And then like this will go away if you can just like use money to buy credits from OpenAI to spend on tokens that is like replaces the talent. And it's like, sort of right now there's like a lot of complexity and like free friction to converting money into real world results, but this will go down a lot once the real world results you acquire this by just spending money on the AIs.
Tokens become your workforce, essentially.
Yeah.
This was an important element that I didn't really realize until after reading this, is that there is this difference in capital between general capital and human capital, the actual labor workforce. And tokenizing the labor workforce seems a little scary. So I'm curious to get your takes on kind of the system, the way this kind of rolls out over time in either maybe best case to worst case scenarios, is what happens as humans get replaced by tokens, and as we kind of reduce our workforce incrementally, does that happen quickly? Does that happen slowly? And what are like the second order effects downstream of that?
Yeah, so let me say a bit about the second order effects here. So I think one of these is just that, so the thing I already mentioned about, for instance, if you have a bunch of money, but you want results in the real world, you're still bottlenecked on, you need to identify talent, you need to hire talent. There's a lot of friction here. Another is that a lot of social mobility today is based on like, you are a talented human and you don't have capital, but you can go out in the world and do something. And you know, people with capital have to pay attention to you. You're like a nimble startup founder or something. And it's like VCs who have a lot of capital just, you know, need you. They will give you money, stuff like this.
I mean, another word for that is the American dream, right?
Yeah. It's what we're all told, right? If you, I live in London now, but I grew up in the States, and, you know, we're all told from a very young age, you know, if you work really hard, if you do well in school, if you go to the right college, you will have a shot at the American dream. And the American dream, it looks like accruing enough capital to be able to own things, or accruing enough capital to be able to make it and have a nice life and fundamentally change your social position. And I think a lot of the argument here is that provided that capital can be entirely substituted for labor here, because you can just sub in AI, your ability to walk that way up the social hierarchy just gets a whole lot harder and maybe gets eliminated.
And then like as a society, I think a lot of social progress and like change depends on this thing that
someone who is not currently incentivized to care about the current status quo comes from the outside and shifts things. And then if she loses ability to have social mobility, it's not just bad for individuals, it makes society more static as a whole.
Okay, so there's this idea if capital becomes a substitute, like a general substitute for labor, which you can imagine if pyramid replacement is true. Basically, what pyramid replacement means is like instead of paying the humans a labor force, I can just like pay the open AI APIs and do this through tokens and pay the geniuses in the data center. And that's my labor force. And so I can just take my capital, which is like my assets, right? My money. And instead of putting my money into the slot machine of human labor, I just put that into the slot machine of AI. And what you're saying is this kind of like destroys social mobility. You talk about, Josh was just asking about like kind of, you know, the best to worst case scenario. And I think maybe these essays are like really focusing on the curse side of things and maybe less on the blessing side. So one could imagine some blessing, but you talk about like, I mean, I guess one of the worst case scenarios, but in a way, this is maybe one of the better worst case scenarios, is this permanent caste system where we're all kind of like locked into the capital ledger that we're born into. And so like maybe if you're born into a nation that has really like, I guess, embraced AI and like your father worked at OpenAI or was in the industry or was early, right? And like really was hooked up to this spigot of capital, like that's your caste. You're kind of locked in. It almost sounds sort of feudal in that way. I mean, not having lived in sort of a strict caste society and certainly embracing the idea of meritocracy, like maybe that all fades away is what you're saying. We're like permanently casted into these kind of capital ledgers.
Yeah. And I think it's worth noting that social mobility before the Industrial Revolution was very low. And I think social mobility depends on this thing of like human talent matters and also the economy is growing and stuff like this. And then, you know, before the Industrial Revolution, if you were rich, probably at some point in the past, your ancestors did something cool and the king gave them a bunch of land and made them aristocrats or something. But then like, then you get the Industrial Revolution, human talent really matters. It's like social mobility is possible by going out inventing things, pushing science, pushing industry, stuff like this. But then if, you know, maybe we'll keep having technological progress, maybe the like amount of abundance in society will go up. But even then you've like lost this element of new people can enter the elite if AI is a like substitute for elite human capital.
Okay, but that's the thing that's counterintuitive, or like what I'm wondering about the argument. So we got the Industrial Revolution, which is sort of machines replacing some human physical labor. And you're saying that was actually good for the humans, basically. Why does that not follow if we get an intelligence revolution that it's not just like good for the humans?
Well, I think the most important differentiating factor for humans as a species is our brains, and that when freed up from physical labor, we're better than some animals at physical tasks. We're worse than other animals at physical tasks. And having the thumb is a pretty great advantage at using tools. But at the end of the day, it seems like the single best advantage that people have is that they can think up new things and execute on them. And so post-industrial societies get these really complex like information economies that spend a whole lot of time producing lots of physical abundance in the real world. And with those resources, using our brains and our heads to come up with even more abundance and more ideas. And you can see this not just in like existing human, existing economies versus old economies. You can see this today between economies. In those kind of more resource curse afflicted states, social mobility is lower because non-human factors of production mean that your ability to have some huge idea and make an outsized impact is also quite limited. Capital begets capital, and your ability, and this is true in every society, but your ability to have outlier talent succeed is less if you don't need outlier talent in the first place to make money.
And maybe also to add on to this like a quick econ thing, it's like, what matters is for like whether it's a substitute or complement for human labor, in the sense of like what like the thing that sets wages is basically like when you add one additional marginal unit of labor, like how much are the returns? And if you have like, you know, pre-industrial revolution, additional unit of labor, you have another additional peasant farmer, it's not very much. Post-industrial revolution, you have an additional unit of labor, but then they command a lot of machines, they command a lot of capital, they actually have like boost the economy a lot, they get high wages. But then if like all the labor is done by AIs, you've got this like total like substitution of humans, then additional unit of labor, output does not change, human wages are very low.
In this model, who are you saying owns the capital, right? So, you know, capital is basically sort of it's property rights, so somebody's got to own it. In this model, do the humans still own it? Does it kind of consolidate to the tech companies, or do the AIs own it? Like, how sci-fi are you getting in this?
So we call for a ban of AI ownership of property and being CEO. So we're willing
really?
To we do wow. call for it. We do. But I don't know how likely that scenario is, but I don't want to preclude it. We went ahead and said, well, it's a pretty cheap ban to do, right? Yeah. It's not that hard to ban it right now. Maybe it's way harder in the future when we've already delegated lots of authority. I think existing law today, at least in most countries, probably does prevent this outcome anyways. But it's worth getting that explicit. But even if it's people, it really matters on how many there are. I think most people in modern economies don't own a whole lot. That doesn't mean that's necessarily a bad thing today, because, of course, your labor is a very powerful thing to trade. And in many cases, you might own way more than you did in previous societies. But it's not the same as being able to own, like, you know, the kind of capital you might need to command many, many, many AI agents that are replacing lots and lots of labor. And I think, Rudolph, you've thought a lot about the kind of ways this create a more static dynamic where, as you mentioned earlier, like, this could lock people into the existing positions pre-intelligence explosion.
Okay, so this idea that capital can now buy labor, so human labor is no longer necessary, there's sort of another implication here, which is that classical liberalism starts to fall apart. And so, you know, post-feudal societies, I think we've just, like, in post-enlightenment, we have generally experienced, not in all places, not in all countries, not in all regions, of course, but we've generally... It's generally led to better human outcomes, right? You know, quality of life, life expectancy in general, wealth, freedoms, the whole concept of just, like, humanism. We've ended terrible practices for humans like chattel slavery, at least in, like, most places. So it's we kind of pat ourselves on the back and we think, like, oh, wow, we've really advanced. We've just, like, gotten some better moral software and we've kind of, like, clearly evolved. I think that what you're arguing, though, is that there's a just like a more utilitarian perspective on this, which is like, maybe you could sharpen this argument for me, but it's like nation states gave labor these rights, citizens these rights, because they were so damn useful. And it was just, they gave the citizens these rights because they needed to attract the labor pools and the brains to develop their economies. And if humans become less necessary for, say, nation states, we've already demonstrated how they may be less necessary for corporations, then that entire, I guess, social construct starts to fade out. Can you sharpen that intuition for us?
I think it's definitely true that there's a little of institutional inertia in the sense of, right now, if you live in a society that really values humans and cares about humans and, like, politically might be willing to, like, introduce a UBI or stuff like this, or, like, universal basic compute or whatever, then, you know, there's a strong chance that, like, this society has a lot of inertia in this direction. But then, like, societies don't exist in a vacuum. They compete with each other. There's a sense in which, like, for instance, out of all the countries in Europe, like, Britain was doing the most to sort of, like, be compatible with industrialization. And therefore, as a result, you know, they were doing a lot of, they were quite politically advanced for their time. They had quite a lot of freedoms. They were, like, good at encouraging industry, stuff like this. And therefore, as a result, like, Britain becomes the preeminent power. And there's a thing of, like, you know, there's a lot of societies, a lot of countries in the world, they're in competition with each other. So it's not just sufficient that, like, if one society makes this choice, it's sort of like they can continue on their own. It also matters, like, which strategy wins overall in the world.
It's not clear to me if this dynamic is bottom up or top down. Is it the states gave this right knowing it would attract better competition, or that workers or people who own capital had more power than a state and were able to demand these? I think about, like, the Magna Carta in Britain, for example, the foundational document for the concept of, like, modern democracy, where landed gentry, people with lots of property, had powers that, you know, weren't necessarily as powerful as the king, but, you know, were in many cases, like, they controlled the factors of production that created wealth for that king. And so this put them in a position where they can make a whole lot of demands upon a king. You see the evolution of British democracy is that it first starts with this, like, landed gentry class. And you know, here in America, voting rights begin, you know, the idea of, like, a self-determined government doesn't start with everyone being involved. It starts with these, like, diffused property-owning men who, because of that position, had some sort of diffused self-relying power. There's this Charlie Munger quote that I think was at the top of the original intelligence curse on my blog, which is just, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's the case that cultural evolution plays no role here. I think it's quite important. But it's also worth asking, like, what is the role that economic incentives play on cultural evolution, and how strong are those incentives? And so I think in the limit, these incentives are probably the dominating force here.
There's this quote, I think, in this part of the essay where you say this, the classical liberal today can credibly claim that the arc of history really does bend towards freedom and plenty for all, not out of benevolence of the state, but because of the incentives of capitalism and geopolitics. But After labor replacing AI, this will no longer be true. Wow. So potentially classical liberalism on the line here. Let's get to the next essay. So we've talked about capital and its importance, how that could be kind of the dominant feature of a post-AGI type society. So let's draw some more implications for what that means for kind of, the nation state's relationship with its citizens. So this is the heart of maybe the intelligence curse. This is where the curse starts to like come down on us even stronger. And the summary is this: with AGI, powerful actors will lose their incentive to invest in regular people, just as resource-rich states today neglect their citizens because their wealth comes from natural resources rather than taxing human labor. And this is the intelligence curse. Why do powerful actors like nation states invest in their people today?
Well, think about it. If I'm a government right now and I want to make a lot of money and I don't have, and maybe I want to make money for a variety of reasons. Maybe I'm altruistic and I want to provide better, you know, care for my citizens. Maybe I'm self-interested and I want my state to do well. There are a host of reasons why you might want this, because money gets you power. But in order to get that right now, you can do a couple of things. One, you can try to find some sort of resource, but maybe you don't have it. Two, you can try to increase your return on an investment. And given that most economies right now really flow through people, developed economies, diverse economies, flow through people and their labor and their work, you can up that return by doing a couple of things. You can really increase the quality of education. You can build infrastructure like roads and public transportation, which helps get investment flowing into areas. You can build these really reliable governance systems to encourage investment. You can foster competitive markets. You can support small business formation. You can do all of these things that make it more likely that your population produces meaningful economic results, and then you can tax them heavier. I think right now in the United States, taxes on income are something like 50%, whereas taxes on corporations are something like 12%. So a share of total tax revenue, 50% derives from income taxes, whereas 12 to 13% derives from corporate taxes for the government. And so in that world, of course, you want to make sure that people are making more money, because if they make more money, well, then you accrue more tax revenue, and you can do more things with that tax revenue. It just so happens that these investments are the kind of things that we associate with a better quality of life, and they also give you better bargaining power. But the other thing, of course, and we wouldn't get into this a bit later, is maybe you impact the ability of that government to maintain or retain power, maybe either through democratic means like voting or through credible threats to an autocratic regime.
Okay.
So you might want to buy those voters off.
Yeah. So you're saying like kind of the public goods, the public infrastructure. Take, for example, just free public education to all its citizens. This is not the government doing kind of like, quote unquote, the right thing for its citizens. This is not governments, nation states of the world just being altruistic and kind of like nice and kind. They're doing it for a reason, for an economic outcome, which is we have an educated population, then we have greater ability to produce GDP, and like government benefits from being able to tax that GDP, and that's how it makes revenue itself. And like this is basically the reason, the incentive for governments to invest in education, or for that matter, any kind of like good thing for its people. Does that analysis miss something? It feels very mechanistic and bleak. Maybe that is the way the world works. But like, you know, is there not like some sense of morality and like doing the right thing here?
So I'll mention one thing here, which is that this analysis doesn't require anyone consciously to be this cynical in government. So for instance, you can imagine in the year 1500, like in Europe under the feudalism, is like maybe there were people who are really altruistic and they want to like, you know, give people free healthcare and stuff like this. But then they get invaded by the neighboring country who like invested more in their military and stuff like this. Whereas then today, it's like the people who were altruistic in like 1800, who were like classical liberals, and like promoting like British and US like political progress, like these are the people in it, I'm sure, of the future, because their values at that point in time were associated with winning strategy.
Well, ask yourself too, just if you hear, I'll tell you nothing about these two politicians, but a politician who wants to increase spending on education and a politician who wants to decrease spending on education, gut check, which one feels more altruistic to you?
Increase, right?
The one that wants to increase.
And I think it is the case here that the incentives are aligned here. The thing that sounds really good and is altruistic also is the thing that returns money to the state. Now, in the world where the state has to cut that education spending because they're in a fiscal crisis, or because making that spending choice would be super irresponsible, maybe they're in some sort of, like Rudolph said, there's like an invasion coming, they've got to up military spending, it doesn't make that other politician any less altruistic in theory. It just means that other politician has really strong countervailing incentives to do something else.
Okay, so it's not altruism. Mm-hmm. It's just a happy coincidence of incentive alignment. That's why we like get beneficial things. It's interesting, going back to the idea of the resource curse, maybe we could talk a little bit more about that, because we do have real-world examples, experiments at play, where there are very resource-rich countries to the extent that they can generate economic returns and taxes, revenue, essentially, to pay for the government based on resources rather than human capital, rather than human labor. And this is the resource curse that we were referring to at the outset of this episode. And we actually, there's a name for these, which are rentier states, I believe. Okay, yeah. So tell us again about the rentier states. Let's get into some more detail here, because this is essentially the experiment at play. Again, if your nation is resource rich, how does it treat its citizens? What are the experiments that we've seen right now in the real world?
So we can look at the raw incentives. There's a very interesting counterargument that I think we actually incorporate, which is that many states have such good institutions that they aren't exposed to these incentives or can avoid these incentives. But at the raw incentive level, I think we talk about like the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example, extremely complicated history, but with literally trillions of dollars in minerals below their feet and hundreds of billions of dollars in, I believe, total revenue from those minerals. And yet their people subsist on a couple of dollars a day. And if the state has the kind of resources that could enable relatively widespread wealth, the question is, why don't they do it? And oftentimes in these states, you can imagine, I think it's very easy for us to imagine in the West, a state far away that is exposed to high levels of corruption or exposed to high levels of inequality because the leaders choose themselves over their people. It just sounds quite foreign to us here in the West. But of course, this is what we see time and time again in many resource curse afflicted states, is that the leaders get rich, or the people who control the mining rights get rich, the oligarchs get rich. But many regular people don't see the benefits of that economic activity because there's no reason to invest directly in them to reap that reward.
Is there an explanation of counterexamples of resource-rich nations that are actually like protecting their citizens like fairly
yeah.
well? So like Norway comes to mind, again, maybe like Canada mm-hmm. sort of comes to mind.
Yeah, like the UAE comes to mind as well.
Yeah, how do you explain that?
So one, I think the key thing here is like how much of one, like when we're talking about rentier states, we're talking about states that have like a very large portion of their revenue coming from natural resources. I think that's, it's a dominating force in their economy. There's, I think we cite it in the piece, but there's these two really interesting examples that the authors give of Norway and Oman as counterexamples of states that don't fall into the resource curse. In Norway's case, by the time Norway discovers oil, they have this really efficient, really anti-corrupt, fantastic democracy where voting incentives kind of override raw capital incentives, where the bureaucracy understands how to do things in really complex ways. And this means that voters have like very real power and the benefits get dispersed in different ways. The voters can outvote capital incentives. In states like Oman in particular had a pretty credible threat of some sort of uprising or revolution. I can't recall the exact example from the paper. I know we cite it directly. And as a result of this, the state capitulates. And I think the kind of analogy that I've used here before is that if you are the person that owns the rents, you'd really like to keep all the rents to yourself. You'd also like to keep your head meaningfully attached to your body. And so if capitulating on that, if paying out people, if doling out the rent money keeps your population in check, you're much more likely to want to do this, because otherwise that credible threat could be quite real. Now, what we say is twofold. One, we think that advanced AI makes it way easier for the state to know everything and suppress things like revolutions. And so we think the revolutionary argument in autocracies is kind of off the table. We find ourselves in being the contrarian position of defending democracy pretty strongly here, which has, I think, become kind of contrarian in some tech circles in recent years, but we actually
it's
think
not
it just
contrarian
is.
Around here. We're big defenders of decentralization, democracy.
But we want, you know, in the Norway example, the question you have to ask is, do you think most states have the kind of like robust and rigorous democracy as Norway, one, and two, do you think the intelligence curse for placing all labor might be stronger? In our case, we think it probably could be stronger, but it really shows us an interesting way out.
That's interesting. So you're basically saying it's just like Norway had the democratic decentralized institutions strong enough to kind of withstand some of the pressures of the resource curse. But the open question
exactly.
is like, how many other countries have that? And when you get into the intelligence curse, no matter what your like institutions, your democratic institutions are, will that be enough to withstand the tidal wave of this intelligence curse? And that's kind of an open question, but it does provide maybe a sliver of hope, which is that with robust institutions, maybe we can start to like, maybe we can withstand the coming tidal wave. I don't want to get into solutions too soon because we're still in the problem, but you like I'll just earmark that right now.
Imagine if your checking account and DeFi wallet finally spoke the same language. That's Mantle Banking, an all-in-one fiat and crypto account. It lets you save, spend, and invest all from one dashboard. Swipe for coffee, stake ME3 yield, or even use virtual cards for payments through Apple Pay. So it feels Web2 simple, yet stays Web3 sovereign. For allocators, meet Mantle Index 4, the S&P 500 of crypto, a tokenized institutional-grade fund seeded with $400 million from the Mantle Treasury and balanced across Bitcoin, Ether, Sol, and yield-enhanced stables. One asset, broad exposure, pure DeFi composability. The momentum is real. ETH vaults, FBTC bridges, and a $2.4 billion community treasury are all powering the next phase of on-chain finance. Mantle brings real-world access, yield, and utility to digital assets. Ready for the next era of on-chain finance that actually belongs in 2025? Explore Mantle at mantle.xyz or follow mantle_official. Mantle, bridging TradFi and DeFi so you don't have to. Have you ever imagined Bitcoin and Ethereum truly working as one, unlocking the full potential of Bitcoin, DeFi, and more? Meet Hemi, a groundbreaking modular network designed precisely for that vision. Co-founded by early Bitcoin core dev, Jeff Garzik. Unlike other layer twos that treat Bitcoin and Ethereum as separate silos, Hemi connects these giants into a single powerful super network. With Hemi, users gain unprecedented asset portability and possibilities, combining Bitcoin security and value with Ethereum's versatility. Hemi's unique innovation, the Hemi Virtual Machine, integrates a fully indexed Bitcoin node directly into an EVM, enabling dApps that seamlessly interact with both networks. And with Hemi's proof of proof, or POP consensus, users benefit from truly decentralized, censorship-resistant, Bitcoin-level security. Since its recent mainnet launch, Hemi has rapidly ascended the ranks as one of the top Bitcoin chains. With a thriving global community and robust ecosystem support, Hemi isn't just building a network, it's shaping the future of Web3, DeFi, and beyond. Visit hemi.xyz/banklist to learn more, discover ways to interact, participate in the leaderboard program, and be part of the community that's uniting Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Yeah, I think what I want to know, as a layman listening to this, who is just on the street and now understanding that he will soon not be able to trade his labor for capital, I'm curious.
You're out of a job.
I'm out of a job. So
it's last podcast.
That's what I'm saying. I'm listening to this. I'm like, okay, well, I can't do this. I am no longer able to trade my labor for capital. What does that look like for the average person? Are they collecting government welfare? Is there universe basic income? How am I able to accrue capital if I am just one of those elementary workers in the workforce?
Well, I guess the question is, how much do you want to get into our solution section right now?
We'll hold that for a second, because there is another element that I was also interested in talking about, which is just the human element. As a human, I like human interaction. I like going to hang out with friends. I like buying homemade things from people. I like meeting the artists that create the art that's on my walls. I really enjoy that connection. And when we introduce this AGI element, this artificial intelligence force, it feels very inhuman and artificial, and it feels very sterile in that way. And when I think, as someone who is experiencing the human experience, I'm really curious, what element does the human nature have on the way this all plays out?
So I think it is definitely true that there's a lot of things where humans have a preference for interacting with humans. And I think this will continue. And I think there will be a lot of like social facing jobs where the humans have a very high bar for replacing that role with a human, with an AI. And I think this does provide a sort of like buffer where I think there will be some jobs that last quite long. It is for like, maybe like a like teacher, or maybe if you're for like interfacing with customers, even if you're like a salesperson who's like very dependent on personal relationships, like humans might prefer that for quite a while. So I guess there's some things about like how charismatic are the AIs, like how like good do they get at like hijacking human social instincts, stuff like this. But there's also a question around then so the humans currently have money, and there's like some capital flowing around the human economy, but there will also be this like the AI is increasingly doing stuff, and it might be like increasingly sort of like the like money flows towards the AI part of the economy. And in particular, like I think like, how are the humans earning the money with which they pay each other for the human services, when at least some of that human money also has to be spent on like doing the AI stuff that probably like keeps them alive, keeps them fed, stuff like this?
Is it all for the workforce, or are there like, how far does this go? So I guess if currently a human thing that I would really be really excited about is to teach my kids something, or to be a father to my children. And how far does that go? Does it get into the household? Does it kind of remove the need for humans through the entire process?
So there's a really good paper that walks through some of the culture elements here. It's called Gradual Disempowerment. We know the authors quite well. It came around the same time that ours did. We focused less on this initial cultural element, mostly because we were trying to isolate what we think is like a really critical variable here on the economic side. But I'll tell you, I had an interesting interaction a couple of days ago with someone who was telling me that they talk to ChatGPT constantly and that they think their dad talks to ChatGPT more than he talks to his kids, that it was like 2 or 3 hours a day, maybe more. And so I think the capacity for machines to alter our relationship with each other seems quite high. I don't have the exact quote that Mark Zuckerberg said in a podcast recently, so I hopefully I'm not butchering this too bad, but it was something along the lines of, you know, the average human has, you know, 4 or 5 friends, the average American has 4 or 5 friends, but they have capacity for 15. We can substitute a lot of that with machines. For me, I'm not excited about this vision. This is really not exciting to me at all. I really value the real world and the people that I get to interact with. And maybe this is something I don't want to impose and say that I get to make a choice, that nobody ever gets to go down that rabbit hole, but it's certainly not the technology that I'm excited about building.
Okay, that's really fascinating, because like when you start getting the family and you talk about just like being a parent or something, or just like being a father, and can an AI really do that better? But like then you get into scenarios where, I mean, a lot of people grow up without their father, right? Just maybe, you know, by route of an early death or just like something else. And like, is an AI maybe providing some parenthood there? And it's, you could, I guess what you guys are saying though is you're acknowledging that, you know, AI cannot replace all of our labor, because we still might want to go to a arts and crafts fair and purchase a piece of artwork for cultural reasons from a real human artist that we just like resonate with and identify with. And that's still going to be a market and economy. What you're saying is like over time, that could become a smaller and smaller and smaller portion of the economy. And even the human's purchasing power in this world could actually decrease, because like where is their wealth to go purchase the artwork actually coming from? And so you could imagine like just that economy, that human to human kind of economy where only humans can provide this, that just gets smaller and smaller over time. And it's kind of a niche. And so like the humans are maybe like, I guess, disempowered, even though these economies still exist.
So yeah, go ahead.
Or even it could be that like, you know, the human wages stay roughly constant. Everyone has like vaguely social, like pro-social jobs. The like money flow into human part of the economy comes from something, something government, something, something existing human wealth. And like those sort of like human wages are what they are today. But then also humans just don't really have political power anymore, because states worry about like, you know, real things like energy and GPUs and like military competition. And all of these fields are done by AI. And then it's, I think the like human role has become a bit like peripheral and not anymore tied to sort of the like real power that exists in the world. And I think I'm a bit worried about that, even if sort of like humans are like have their wage level at what it is right now.
Another way to think about it too is I hear a lot that people will always want human teachers, right? Because there's this human interaction that you have with the teacher and it's really hard to replace. A relevant question though is what will be the demand for schools? What is the incentive for states to fund mass public education in a world where they aren't receiving a return there? That doesn't mean it isn't going to happen, but you should look at the underlying economic incentives. And it could be the case, as you describe, where like many, many fields are automated. And so the money flowing in this human economy is just increasingly limited, or, you know, dwindles over time. I think there are a lot of ways which you can reach a pretty bad outcome through different mechanisms here. And a lot of our solutions base is focused on trying to keep humans meaningfully economically involved in many different ways, while also strengthening democratic incentives and democratic structures so that they can override capital incentives when they need to.
Well, just if we could stretch this a little farther and kind of like imagine a world here. So like what, how do future nation states actually like make money in an AI dominated economy? Like how do they tax? Like obviously now our tax mechanisms are just income tax, capital gains tax, consumption type tax, excise tax, increasingly tariffs. Well, that's fun. So, but the nation state is really going to have to reorient around AI labors. And, that's another interesting question. It's like, maybe actually the nation state is not the one in charge. I mean, we're in a world of nation states, but that is kind of a post-feudal model that kind of arose on the back, really, of the last major technological change, which was the Industrial Revolution. Maybe we're going to reorganize. Balaji Srinivasan has this concept of the network state. And you sort of wonder if maybe some of these AI labs could be in a position to accrue such power that they actually become the dominant force, some kind of like, you know, open AI network state, complete with, you know, like a flag and Sam Altman as the president. I mean, like, who knows, right? What? How do you guys see this playing out?
Yeah, I think there's definitely this question over, like, do nation states continue as the main form of political organization, or like main form of organization of power in the world? And I think there's something where like, So one, I think you should definitely prioritize that these things are pretty sticky. Sort of like even the Catholic Church, you know, they were extremely powerful. They run Europe for a few centuries in the past, but and like you know they don't run Europe anymore.
They're actually making
a lot of commentary about AI recently. They're like finally revived. Right? It's like this stuff decays quite slowly.
I think this is Rudolph has been subject to me spending the last couple of days really nerding out about this. I literally just had the Catholic Church
in AI.
Yeah, so I have a reading list that I'm compiling right now. Because there's the most recent pope, the slight sidetrack, the most recent pope, he's now said publicly one of the reasons that he took Leo XIV is because Leo XIII had this very prescient encyclical called Rerum Novarum on the Industrial Revolution in the 1890s, and he views AI as a similar style of societal reorganization.
Wow.
So Pope Francis had a whole lot of commentary here. I've got a reading list I'm working through right now. Yesterday we were in Oxford and I was talking to a friar.
Josh, new guest request. We got to get the Pope on
Limitless.
Let's get
the Pope. Yep.
Ask his thoughts on AI. All right. Mm-hmm. We'll do this in the Vatican. Sounds good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, fascinating. So we don't really know what the organizing political structure might be in this new world, but we could imagine it changes. But you're also saying that, hey, the nation state is pretty sticky. The Catholic Church is still doing like big things. Maybe it'll fade somewhat. Probably won't go away. But that's kind of a TBD. Like, we don't know yet.
Yeah, and also, like, if we get AGI Lab, the network states, like, the same incentives kind of apply to them by default. And also, they aren't by default democracies unless they become democracies. So.
Yeah, a core observation is that AI can be both destabilizing and centralizing. And this seems kind of counterintuitive, but it could be the case that there's lots of very quick disruption, and the winners of that disruption that can very quickly accumulate power and capital. I'm not saying that is certain, but that is one scenario you could see here, is that it can both destabilize a whole lot of things and then centralize power among the winners.
Yeah, the centralization of power seems to be a massive theme for you guys. Like, where I'm getting out of this is definitely some worry about AI. I wouldn't call it doomerism, right? There could be a scenario where AI kills humanity. I think it's just like you can see that point. That's not really the focus. The focus is more this attractor basin towards authoritarian totalitarianism, right? Which could be possible. I mean, this is even Daniel Schmachtenberger's work. I don't know if you guys have looked him up, but he talks about just with all of these tech revolutions, what we could see is this attractor basin towards like total society control to actually keep our tech in place. There's one more concept though we got to go through before
power concentration thing, where I think thing that I think people, so throughout history, we've had really terrible tyrants and dictators, really terrible centralization of power. But like all of them have fundamentally been limited by the fact that whoever the dictator is, they're not infinitely competent. They can't think incredibly fast. They still need a lot of other people to do things for them. They somehow need to get buy-in of like a big bureaucracy and then also like population that they rule over. And like fundamentally their power like is still rooted in humans. If you're a dictator, you're constantly paranoid about everyone else like overthrowing you. Like this is like fundamental.
You know
like,
what? They also get strokes. They're life expectancy is only about 80 years.
I didn't know. Even though they could pay for such good healthcare. Exactly.
Yes.
But then like once you don't need the like bureaucracy of humans working for you, once you don't need the human military, you just have AI bureaucracy, you have like AI military, you don't need the population to run your economy. The like constraints on how total the totalitarianism can get a lot worse.
Indeed they do. Okay. All right. There is a way out, guys. All right.
There is, yes.
For Limitless listeners, if you're in despair now, never fear. We've got some solutions for you. But one more concept to cover. So this is, I think, the last essay before you kind of like conclude all of the things and give some of your recommendations for the way out, which is this idea of the social contract. Okay. An essay titled Shaping the Social Contract. And what you're saying is the intelligence curse is breaking the social contract. And I really like this diagram that you sort of show, which is just like this nice equilibrium balance of power. You've got like three boxes here. You've got powerful actors. So these would be corporations, nation states, you know, the big powerful networks. You've got the people, and then you've got the rules. Okay. And so there's a dependency. There's lines of dependency between the powerful actors, the people, and the rules. So the powerful actors, they need the people for value. We've already established that. They need labor, right? And so that's like people plus one for the people. The people can displace the powerful actors. We've seen that throughout history, French Revolution, just like American Revolution, right? If the powerful actors get too totalitarian, we stage revolts, right? The people are strong. And what we've done is we've created these social contracts, basically rules for society. And so these rules are moral codes, but just like more I guess, yeah, like in more detail, it's kind of our legal system. It's the Constitution of the U.S. It's the Magna Carta. So there's this, and the people can influence the rules. The powerful actors have to, they're constrained by the rules. We get the balance of power, separation of church and state, three co-equal branches, all of these things, right? It's like all very nice. And that's our current setup. That's the status quo. What you're saying is this whole AGI thing kind of disrupts the social contract because it means the people can't displace powerful actors, as you were just saying, Rudolph. It means the powerful actors, so the nation states, don't need the people for value. They can just pay, you know, for tokens in the AI geniuses in a data center. And then the powerful actors have the ability to influence the rules. The whole social contract is messed up. Did I, like, flesh this idea out a little bit more? Is this kind of what you're saying?
So I'll zoom in on just a single interaction here, which I think helps articulate this. And I know you're listening based, so let's zoom in on software engineer at Google. And let's say it's 2021, which I think, if I'm correct here, is like, that's the big year where, like, it was, everyone is getting paid crazy amounts of money. You are negotiating with Google in your contract, and you have something that they want. In this case, you have, like, you're really good at what you do. They want to hire you. Well, because of this, you get to extract a whole lot of concessions. You're competitive on the marketplace. You get to ask for more RSUs. You get to ask for more stock. You get to ask for more money. You also get things like the free cafe on campus because they've got to attract you somehow. Or I think it's like 16 or 17 restaurants in Mountain View on their case. It's absolutely crazy. It's cool campus. You get a lot of these benefits because of that exchange. And of course, Google gets something out of you too, because they might pay you $400,000. But as long as they've done their, you know, vetting here, they're going to make a whole lot more than $400,000 from your labor. But everybody wins in this relationship. Now imagine that Google is able to replace your labor with a machine that can code way better than you. Well, this really disrupts the relationship, right? Because let's say, you know, in this case, it can create value for Google at a cheaper cost than you. It costs, I don't know, like $100,000 a year or $150,000 or $200,000. That's in the price range right there, where it's really economically sensible for Google to cut you out of the process, but difficult for you to then go, like, create, you know, 10 trillion clones of yourself and go compete with Google. And in the limit, this creates a world where powerful actors can get more and more entrenched as capital substitutes for labor more and more perfectly. Your ability to displace them goes down, while simultaneously, your ability to bargain with them also decreases because you don't have anything that they need. This might create a situation in which powerful actors get to set the rules and you are constrained by them, and it's very difficult for you to alter that relationship.
That follows through to the government too, right? And it's basically social contract with its citizens when, like, they don't need the citizens very much anymore. I guess my question here, or a bit of pushback, is, you know how we call them a social contract, right? And that's because it's enforced socially. Yeah, there's power of the state, there's military, there's kind of like monopoly on violence types of things. But over time, human societies have been able to, like, construct their own social contracts. Like, what is something like the Constitution that's just like a set of laws and legal codes and ideas that we all agree on in this nation called the United States of America, right? Like, we put that in place. It's,
yeah.
Yuval Noah Harari calls these kind of like myths, right? They're just like these shared beliefs that power so much of human society. So my question is, like, okay, if we get to kind of choose social contracts, why don't we just pick one that doesn't screw over all the humans, that doesn't screw over citizens and the labor? Like, we put these things together. They're just shared myths. They're socially enforced. Why don't we pick one that's good? And by the way, if this AGI thing comes true, won't we have abundance too? Won't we have, like, basically 10% GDP a year? Won't we have like fantastic wealth? At least somebody's making the wealth. And so this abundance, shouldn't this relieve the competitive pressures? We don't have to think about, you know, the basics of food and shelter because it's all provided for us. And so we're not in this competitive game anymore. We can just think about what makes society happy and pick a social contract that enforces that.
I guess maybe one historical example here is, like, the British Empire tried to enforce a social contract on the US, or before it was the US, and then the Americans were like, okay, actually, we don't think this is fine. And it was like a reality check to Brits, and it turned out the Brits did not have the ability to enforce that. The institution's real power was against them, and then the Americans wrote their own social contract, which became the Constitution. And I think there's definitely a lot of power in, like, culture, institutional inertia, just, like, the beliefs that people have, just, like, myths in the Harari sense, to, like, steer things and keep things on track. But then, like, over a long enough time scale, or enough stuff happening in the world wall that like checks like, okay, is there something behind this? Like if someone tries to change that, either like, you know, in a bottom up way, because, you know, there's some like a social media movement, or like from a top down way, if the like leader of a country decides to do something, like, are those reality checks? Like, does the economic structure and the political structure like push back against that successfully? Or is it sort of like, oh, like you can actually shift it? Because then if you can shift it, probably over time, it drifts kind of in the direction of the incentives over time.
How about this abundance idea, though? Going back to that, right? So like where we have abundance, AIs are creating all of these things. Won't that relieve competitive pressure for us? Like, can't we get a utopia out of that?
So I think at a core, you should be really concerned about any arrangement where the long-run arrangement has you with very little actual power. And so I think it could be there's lots of abundance, but you aren't creating any of it. You aren't involved in the creation of any of it. And so your material power here is entirely political. This is just way less stable. Another thing to think about here is that I think we talked about this in the essay, that it's not really clear that competitive pressures or human greed have this intrinsic stopping point. I think to paint an additional example, though, here, it could be the case that the worst outcome is that we have abundance, but you don't have any say in what happens afterwards. And so your needs are met, but your political reality is quite constrained. I think about a state like China, which has like been able to simultaneously lift a whole lot of people out of poverty. And one of them, you know, the Chinese miracle is a thing that happened night. Hundreds of millions of people get lifted out of poverty under Deng Xiaoping. But simultaneously, I wouldn't say that this has resulted in like crazy political freedoms for people in China. It could be that your material conditions improve, and yet simultaneously your power is unaffected. And this has been quite a, you know, Herculean effort by the Chinese state to keep this equilibrium going. And the Chinese state is in many ways like responsive because it's afraid of losing legitimacy, or really afraid of like revolutions. It has a zero tolerance policy on protest. But that is one outcome. We just happen to think that you should be deeply concerned about scenarios in which you don't have the material power to guarantee abundance for yourself. And if you're written out of the economic social contract, you are at this point at the mercy of the political one. We think the political one is better than nothing. We advocate really hard for strengthening that political contract so we can get to that outcome. But we don't think in the limit, it's what I'd the only thing I'd want to be relying on. I'd really want to make sure that I have some real stake in the game here.
One last objection to all of this, which is basically Professor Arvind, he wrote The Intelligence Curse. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he has kind of this riff on...
He wrote
AI Snake Oil.
AI Snake Oil.
I was going to say congratulations.
He plagiarized your work, so I just want to let you know right now.
AI Snake Oil. I'd be frightened to find out he wrote... You know,
sorry,
like,
Arvind.
Ooh, that's good to know. I didn't realize that title was taken.
AI Snake Oil is... Yeah. He has this riff where he talks about... Basically, he's kind of downplays AGI. He basically thinks that AI is kind of like more akin to regular tech. And like one of his riffs is there's a difference between AI capability and power. So there's capability, right? All of this knowledge, intelligence inside of a data center. But then that's different than power. It's kind of constrained. Like maybe that idea of you guys said earlier, part of the solution is not giving AI is the ability to accrue their own wealth, right? It's like wealth would be a vector for power. We don't necessarily have to give AIs wealth and power. And so capability and power could be somewhat isolated. Maybe this whole thing is just a question of like who gets the power. How does that idea, the difference between AI capability and power kind of like factor into this whole analysis?
So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that it could be the case we don't delegate this power to AI systems and then it's relegated in the hands of people. Is that right?
Exactly. There's always humans in the loop, you know, like they can't get their own bank accounts or something. They can't accrue capital. We always have kind of a check on them. We don't have to give them the keys to the car.
Well, I think nothing that we've argued is contingent on AI having this power in a self-directed way. One of the biggest oppressors of people in human history is other people. Totalitarian states require a whole lot of people doing that oppressing. And it could be the case that we've actually done is we've just expanded the power differential. We've made it like that some people are far more powerful than others. This is already true today, but in the era of liberal capitalism and liberal democracies, your power as an individual, as a unit of society, has just really never been greater. And what we're saying here is it could be the case that for a couple of people, because they have existing access to capital and convert this directly into results, this could be a world where they have just such dramatic outlier ability to shape the world that their ability to materially impact your environment is really, really high, and your ability to resist that is even lower than usual.
Okay. I feel like we fleshed out the intelligence curse to a sufficient degree. Let's talk about the solution. Let's talk about how to break out of this intelligence curse. You've got three words here. You've got avert, you've got diffuse, and you've got democratize. where do you want to take this? You want to start with Avert? How do we get out of this?
Let's work it back. I think let's initial affirmation. Yeah.
Okay. Start with democratize then. So this is, what's the idea here? That we're distributing the power to all of the people? We're just not concentrating this in the hands of AI labs and AI models themselves? How do you think about the democratize word?
So I think the way we'll flow this, if this makes sense, is I want to walk through really quickly just the observations backward, because we started with democratize as the observation, and then I think we can kick it off with Avert after that. And then what I mean by this is I just want to walk through the whole argument chain real quick, read off the kind of initial observation that we have on why we need each step here.
Yeah, so I guess the flow here is basically, as we mentioned, Norway, for example, solved the resource curse. They just had good institutions, and therefore they can just all go to polls and vote for, everyone's well off, and then they distribute the oil wealth between the people, and everything is great. Mm-hmm. And so it's great if we can get to the point where we have this very democratic thing. A lot of people have power. They can affect the decisions that are made. We get broad distribution of the benefits of AI, stuff like this. And there's various ways. We list some ways in which technology for coordination and various other things can help with this in our last section here. But yeah, this is basically great. There's various ways we can build tech to make this easier. And then the point we're making is that to be in the state where you can democratize and have that be a stable equilibrium, often what matters is that you get political power often when you have the economic power. So then this brings us the idea that you need diffusion as well. You want to diffuse the benefits of AI to people such that then everyone gains in power, gains in capability. Capabilities, continues having some stake in the economy and some ownership stake over it. And therefore, this makes the step about democratization more stable, because then it is actually an incentive of the powerful actors, of people, of everyone, is to keep the a democracy in place. So then we've gone from democratize to diffuse. And then, so there's this worry that sometimes people have is if you diffuse AI too much, if you give everyone the AI, you're just giving out this powerful technology that people can use to do things create bioweapons or do all sorts of nasty cyber attacks or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the AI takes over because it's misaligned and it is very bad for everyone. And therefore, in order to make the diffusion step safe, in order to prove that, you want to avert the various catastrophes that could happen from widespread AI. And we're especially excited here about hardening the world against things like bio attacks, against cyber attacks, and also just making sure that we don't mess up on the alignment problem.
So from that, we work backwards here, right? So democratization is clearly a way out, because democratic incentives can beat capital incentives. You can ensure all the things you want out of that. But we've noticed this pattern where your economic power correlates with democracy and is oftentimes the engine of that. So then we want to diffuse, but also we want to make sure that diffusion happens in a way that doesn't create the kinds of catastrophes that either would just be bad in and of themselves or could give license for states or other actors to really powerfully centralize. So we have this Avert section. So we kick things off with Avert and this backwards chain, and we've realized that in order to get to the democratization, there are some steps we're going to have to take first.
Okay, so democratize is all about power diffusion to the people so that the people can hold the institutions in check. But it's a political type of thing, right?
Yes.
And we have had democratic protocols in the past, right? Yeah. Oh, and we have them right now, one person, one vote. We'll come back to that because I want to get into some tangible examples. But that is about distribution of power, I guess, and the humans having this power and retaining this power. Mm. And you're saying one way in order to do that is that other D word, which is diffuse. And I think diffuse means give everybody access to AI tools. It can't just be a small percentage, maybe. Maybe you could sharpen the intuition there. But diffusion is about the distribution, the tools in the hands of everybody. And then Avert is just making sure that we don't completely go off the rails. We have a misaligned AI or some sort of bioweapon. And also, I love that you say this because this is super important. A lot of people miss this. Avert without requiring centralizing control. Because the attractor basin, when you start to clamp down and you avert and you sign letters like pause AI, or Nick Bostrom proposed kind of a high-tech panopticon where the government has to surveil everybody to make sure they're not doing a bioweapon with their LLM at home, right? Then we get this attractor basin of totalitarian, authoritarian regimes that we then can't get out of. So you're saying avert this bad outcomes without requiring centralized control.
Okay. Exactly.
So,
That's a logic chain we flow through. And the reason why we work through avert, diffuse, democratize, and the piece, as opposed to the logic chain where you go backwards, is because we think it's going to be really hard to diffuse unless you avert, and really hard to democratize unless you diffuse. So this is kind of like the logic chain works backwards, and then we present it forwards, if that makes sense.
Okay, it does. All right, can we get into some real world examples? So avert.
Let's start with averts. Let's kick it off. So I think the core observation here is that actually AI can do bad stuff. And this is like sometimes unpopular to say it's funny. I think we're in a position where we're saying unpopular truths to lots of different people, and certain truths are more popular to certain communities than others. And I think it is the case that AI can make it a whole lot easier for a lot of people to do bad things. And it can also make it a whole lot easier for systems themselves to, you know, lose control of them and take actions on their own. And so our observation here is pretty simple. It'd be really bad if that's the end state. AI is something that is bad for us and not good for us. And secondly, that historically, these kind of potential bad outcomes are the really powerful forces that justify centralization. You can see this here where just a host of tragedies. I think a lot about on the September 11th attacks and how as a result of 9/11, the government took very broad power grabs. The USA Patriot Act, which is actually, fun fact, an acronym. It was the response a couple of months later that resulted in what I would argue was a pretty significant restriction of civil liberties for Americans. It gave the government warrantless wiretapping capacities. Section 702 in particular has been quite controversial for a host of reasons, and I won't take a side on that argument. But the point is that it rapidly expanded government power. And government power, once distributed, is very hard, or once unlocked, is very hard to get back. The other observation that's important here, though, is that if AGI could, in fact, do a whole lot of economic tasks, you're not just centralizing a technology. This isn't just giving only nukes to the government, which is a pretty common sense argument. You are also centralizing into a couple of points of failures the development of the technology that might run your entire economy. In this case, it kind of looks like centralizing the means of production into the hands of a single or a couple of actors.
That was another essay somebody wrote a while ago.
I think we don't cite that one. We do cite State Revolution as an example of it is, we don't think that the idea of the transition state, where a couple of people have all of the power and also all of the economic power, is a good one. That's a state where you don't have very much power, and historically your Stalin risks are pretty high here. Your risks of, drawing the wrong leader out and putting them in the apparatus that you've built are pretty high.
Your P. Stalin, I guess, goes.
I think in another essay we called it P. Stalin specifically. It's not in this one. It's not. It's in a. Nice. We have this piece on Taz and Knowledge, and we did in fact call it P. Stalin.
Okay. Those are the goals. So how do we get there? I think one thing you cite, which is near and dear to our hearts, is Vitalik Buterin's defensive accelerationism. Maybe you could flesh that out as a part of the solution here.
Yeah, I guess the basic idea of differential technology development or differential acceleration, whatever it's called this month, is that we can choose which order technologies arrive in to some extent. We can push the technologies we like and that help us guard against risks and help humans, and we can then just hopefully get these technologies before we get to the bad worrying technologies. And for instance, we probably make sure that by the time ChatGPT can do a cyber attack for you, that we're getting to the point where our cyber defenses are good. And at the point where the AIs can design bioweapons, that we've hardened the world against bioweapons to a significant extent. And so this is true in the averse section, is also true in diffuse and democratize. I think the core sort of spirit of most of our proposals is this thing of let's please build a technology that enable the good things before we get to the threats. And actually by building the technologies and by making them to come faster, we can avert a lot of these risks.
A lot of these things are defensive too, right? When you talk about biosecurity, it's more on the defensive low-key focus, or cybersecurity is kind of defending from attackers. Cryptography is sort of similar in that way, but we also need physical security. AI alignment, of course, the industry is focused on that, but that's another element of the averting catastrophe here without centralizing. All right, let's get to diffuse. Okay, so what does diffuse mean? To me, that's just making sure that everybody, every human has AI superpowers, the example that the tech CEOs give us is even Tim Cook doesn't have a better iPhone than you kind of thing, right? We all have the equal access to iPhones, and that's great. So does diffuse mean we all have equal access to these models and other people can't kind of take them away? Is it open source? What are the practical ways to diffuse this?
Yeah, so I think basically the thing you want to do is help as many people as possible benefit economically from AI as quickly as possible, such that by the time the really radical AI hits, people are sort of like, first of all, there are more people who are like owners, there are more people who have like built companies, stuff like this. And then also you've like distributed technology more benefit, like everyone's gone on the AI power up. I like your phrase about, you know, everyone gets superpowers from AI. And then so in terms of like, grand strategy here, we have this diagram at some point where we show that like you have these like two stages of diffusion, where like first when AI is augmenting, you sort of like you want to diffuse AI, which helps create decentralization. Like you diffuse AI and sort of like just the AGI labs have the AI, they use it to benefit themselves, everyone in society has access to the AI. And what this means is that you get to like decentralization, because like the benefits of AI has been more widely spread. And then like the fact that you have decentralized the AI then helps you also diffuse the AI, because then like once the humans are automated, they're going to be automated not by the big AI labs, but their own AIs, and they still control the fruits of labor of the AIs that they own.
How supportive are you guys of open source then, models in this, and like open source weights and just like all of that, that kind of movement? Is that a key?
Yeah, broadly pretty supportive, especially in worlds where we've done a lot of the hard work here, and on the hard work on proofing the world against the biggest disasters. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think to kind of break this down concretely, this looks like two phases. There's this first phase where right now we're on this track where actually AI agency isn't that good, and yet everyone is investing more and more time into getting agency better. This opens up this interesting market opportunity where AI augmenting tools are both like underinvested in and probably way better. Think about Cursor for a second. I know I keep coming back to Cursor. I love those guys. Cursor is not a tool that does all of the coding for you entirely. It is a tool where usually a software engineer who really understands what they're doing is like in the driver's seat. And it's enabled vibe coding. It's enabled a lot of people who don't know exactly how to do it to still set the high level direction. But ultimately, you are in charge of what's happening. You are steering the ship. There's this huge market opportunity to build more tools in that space right now and expand the window of AI human augmentation. We don't think this is like the long-term permanent solution, but going ahead and starting in that direction now can both access like untapped economic incentive and really focus on what we can do today. What we're then excited about in the future is this a whole bunch of concepts here, but one of them is something like aligning models directly to the user. Most people have some sort of like hidden knowledge that is very difficult to gather. And if you ultimately want like the single superintelligence singleton, you're going to want to have access to all that information. This gives you a wedge point wherein maybe it is the case that like you aren't the perfect data source because you are slow relative to your AIs in 2050. But it could be the case that there's this like AIs that are trained off of your tacit knowledge of your data. They understand you and could behave like you and could represent your taste and judgment faster. And these AIs are acting throughout the broader economy and they're interacting with other systems. Maybe the systems are smarter, but you have access to that information behind that AI. And so this is a world where first we've extended the augmentive window, and second we've aligned systems directly to the user such that even as the systems take off, they're still tied in a meaningful way to the user, and therefore the user gets compensated in some way, shape, or form by their economic activity.
Okay, that's cool. All right, let's talk about this last point then in more concrete terms. So democratize, right? So how do we do that? How do we, you know, let the humans still maintain some power, right? We're very used to like one person, one vote. I mean, are you talking about concepts like maybe you have an AI lawyer, like you have the right to some sort of AI lawyer or data model to represent you? Is like, how do we really, you know, ensure that democracy and human ability, political agency doesn't decrease in this world?
Yeah, so I think, so we take a very tech-centric perspective here. This is not the essay in which we're going to go out and propose how we solve everything in politics, but I think one thing that is underappreciated again is just like, if you push forward technologies that make governance and like verification and coordination and trust easier, then it becomes easier for society to like decide to do the bad things and to not do, sorry, to decide to do the good things and decide to avoid the bad things. So like there are some ways in which like AI might help with this in particular, like the AI might help policymakers understand what voters think. You can imagine that, you know, yeah, and then like in addition to helping understand what policymakers think, you know, the AIs can advocate on your behalf, especially if you have a model that is aligned to you in particular. You can imagine that the AI is like, you know, you can have like provable guarantees that there's some like particular AI system that is making a judgment that is like more incorruptible than a human. You can imagine the AI like auditing information. There's this like fundamental difficulty with using humans to audit that the humans have long-term memory, whereas the AIs, you just like, you know, use the AI, it's like process some context and then the AI is deleted, but then it returns like yes or no on like whether you're like abiding by some protocol or like building a bioweapon. So like you can like audit things without humans having knowledge about it afterwards. in like a bunch of ways like this, where like technology gives you building blocks for like governments that might be and like more effective and more representative of the desires of the people than we can do right now, is just like stacking humans into bureaucracies and having like laws about that.
I think these three words give us a good framework for directionality, even if you can't solve everything in one essay, of course. Just like one last lens and filter for avert, diffuse, and democratize. Let's say one society kind of like chooses to do this and puts these things in place in a more intentional way, but another society chooses not to. And there's this kind of like geopolitical race condition here, which is like we're in kind of a, you know, some sort of arms race for AI. Like, does your essay in The Intelligence Curse have anything to say about kind of that? Like, how do we, you know, like, one society chooses to go in the direction of trying to solve the intelligence curse, but another society races faster, fully embracing, like, the curse. They don't care. They, like, basically, do the authoritarian, totalitarian societies win, you know, like, no matter what? And so are we kind of, like, screwed, even if we in the U.S. or we in the West kind of choose these ways out?
So I think here is one of the things where the differential tech development approach is really powerful, because it's fundamentally not about taking a sort of cut to yourself and becoming less competitive and potentially being overrun by more safety-oriented actors. It's about developing the technology such that if they exist, doing the safe, good, pro-human thing is the winning strategy. And therefore, it, like, shifts the equilibrium. It's not just about, like, it's not reliant on coordination with other actors.
I like that. So we are doing the Munger thing of trying to get the incentives correct.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I will say incentives aren't everything. And I think we talk a little bit about some policies, especially in the democratized section. We talk about some of the more boring ones you hear all the time about stuff like campaign finance reform and reforming anti-corruption laws and strengthening bureaucratic competence. And these all sound kind of boring today. But a really key thing is if you think incentives are about to get radically different and the self-interest of politicians might be much more powerful than it was in years previous, it is really important that the leaders that you're electing in the next couple of years are leaders that you would trust to make good decisions on your behalf in stressful situations. That integrity element that we've kind of lost in modern politics is much more important than ever, because one of the ways you can square like great man theory of history away with like a more incentives dominant view is that oftentimes the great men in history are those that take a decision that looks against the incentives and is ultimately the correct one. Mm. You really want to maximize your chance of grabbing one of those leaders when critical decisions come down, because you could spend and you should spend as much effort as you can to get the incentives right, but you really also want to make sure the person that you have there is someone who at that critical moment might make a decision that is against those incentives if it matters, if it's important for your well-being. So there's that boring answer of you should vote for people who you actually trust, but you actually should vote for people who you actually trust.
Interesting. Unfortunately, it also feels like we're in a shortage of great men these days, at least in our politics. This has been very fascinating. I guess my question as we end this is, what should listeners do with this information? Is there anything kind of actionable? I think it's a super valuable mental model and kind of like, hey, you might be out of a job. Mm-hmm. But what do people do, I guess, personally with this information? What do you recommend listeners, you know, take action on?
Yeah, I'd be just a big fan of, you know, go to the solution section of our essay series. We have a lot of specific tech ideas, you know, like read through this. If you're someone who might build something, you know, go and build something of this list or read this list, have your own idea for something in it, like that is like helps these same goals and go build it out. And it's like, if we build the right technology that makes the equilibrium the good one, then
yeah, I hear this meme a lot in some of the more like AI safety communities that, oh, if it's something that has like market value, the market will solve it. The market is made up of people. People are in the market and they do things. And so you actually have, if you're going to do differential tech development, then some startup founders got to wake up and decide, okay, I'm going to go build this thing. And a VC's got to decide to back them. And we're not being, we're not pontificating here. We can talk a bit more about it in the future, but the two of us are currently actively involved in taking a slice of this agenda and building this out ourselves. Okay. So we're going to go down this rabbit hole ourselves because it's really easy to point at a problem. It's pretty hard to build a solution. What we're much more excited about is building out the solution space. But I think there's stuff for people who aren't just in the tech community. There are policies that government should be thinking about enacting today. We call, for example, for like Operation Warp Speed for the DX-style technologies, the kind of things that could actually prevent major catastrophes and enable this like culture of innovation and democratization. Governments could be incentivizing that right now. I mean, Trump first term did Operation Warp Speed. The bright people are in place to do something like that again, this massive moonshot. I think voters can start really thinking critically about what's going to happen in the next couple of years and electing politicians on those grounds. And if you're a student, I think I've had a blog post somewhere talking about, like, depending on who you are, what career decisions you might want to be making. Because again, if you think diffusion pressures are real, and it might take a while for this to accelerate, there are still some roles where it's pretty obvious that are going to go down first. Yeah. Doing bigger, bolder things right now that actually require you to learn how to fail and be your own actor is really great preparation for a world where you might be able to command an army of agents or a lot of augmentative tools, even if the big company isn't hiring junior analysts anymore. So there's a lot of things you can do right now today to both at a macro level, get us on the right path, or at a micro level, orient yourself for the coming wave.
Great.
So Luke and Rudolph, we spent the last 90 minutes kind of defining the intelligence curse, walking through it, providing solutions. I would love to end this on a positive note, on something a little optimistic. What happens if we solve the intelligence curse? I mean, what is the payoff? What do we get for solving this problem?
We are talking about what could be the greatest revolution technologically of inhuman, at least at any time previously in human history, and maybe like the final huge thing. The promise of that is honestly hard to fathom. It's things like curing diseases that we couldn't imagine, of actual total abundance, of unlocking crazy amounts of resources, of really being able to provide what would have been just, you know, in this year, an experience only to the ultra elites, to everyone. That is a world that I want to be able to live in, where we can do things like, you know, abolish poverty and abolish disease. And if we can get this right, the promise of artificial intelligence is that instead of having less agency and less control over your world, you get more with a whole lot less of the drawbacks. And I don't know, that's a vision I'm pretty excited about.
That's a vision I can get very excited about too. I wanted to thank both of you, mm-hmm. Luke and Rudolph, for joining us today, walking us through everything. I know you guys mentioned you were working on some stuff. Where can people find you?
So we've got a contact form or an email on intelligence-curse.ai. We're both also on Twitter. I think my handle is Luke_Drago_Rudolph. Yours is?
Mine is currently at LRUDL_.
Yeah. So if you want to reach out to us through the contact form there, or if you want to reach out to us on Twitter, we're both mm-hmm. pretty active, unfortunately. We definitely tweet a little too much, and that's all right.
Hey, for better or worse, but we very much appreciate you joining us today, walking us through this entire intelligence curse. I'm sure everyone listening now has a lot to chew on, a lot of interesting new questions to ask, a lot of new things to consider, whether it be the exciting case, the optimistic ending that we landed on, or any of those varied outcomes that we also discussed on the show. So Luke and Rudolph, thanks again. Thank you so much for joining us on the episode today.
Thank you so much. And I guess the last thing I could say is I'm super excited, super optimistic and super excited where this could go. So I think even if we know about the problem, we also know how to solve, or we have a guess on how to solve it. I think people should get more excited about jumping at that solution.
Mm. Awesome.
Yeah, please really build optimistic. The tech that will save the world.
Absolutely. I love that. That's a really optimistic note to end it on. So thank you all again, right. And I appreciate you guys taking the time.
Take care.
Thank you.